Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Digging out of an economic crisis can be a lot more complicated than getting into one. It can take a lot more time, too. While there are positive signs that we are climbing out of the recession, there is still considerable fallout, especially for young couples and recent college grads. Jobs are still hard to find for newcomers in the job market. College debt is overwhelming for many. The housing market decline and the resulting loss of wealth was especially painful for young homeowners. What are the lessons learned and how can they be applied in future financial crises? With me to talk about that and other financial issues are two members of the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank. Ray Bashara is policy officer and director of the Fed's Household Financial Stability Initiative. And Bill Emmons is assistant vice president at the Fed and chief economist for the Household Financial Stability Initiative. Also with us is Michal Grinstein-Weiss, associate director of the Center for Social Development at Washington University. She is considered an expert in the field of building assets. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Don.
Certainly is a timely subject. Unfortunately, it's been timely for far too long, hasn't it? Ray, let me begin with you. What is the initiative that we're talking about?
The initiative around household financial stability is really trying to recognize that the household sector needs to have particular focus. And our particular focus within that is the household balance sheet. We recognize that many families are fragile. They're falling backwards. They don't have the savings, the assets to move themselves forward. And so the idea was, let's look at families and look at their balance sheets in particular and see if we can figure out how those balance sheets matter for the stability and mobility of families, but also for the growth of the nation.
Bill, what exactly comprises the balance sheet?
The assets are things like cars and financial assets, business assets, and houses. It would be the main categories on the left-hand side of the balance sheet, and on the right-hand side of the balance sheet are the liabilities. And the two main types we would think about would be mortgage debt or other kinds of debt. So that could be student, as you said, student loans, car loans, credit card loans. And then the third item is the difference between assets and liabilities. That's net worth or wealth. And that's one of the things that we're most focused on.
Michal, why are young people so badly hit or so badly hurt this time around?
I think a lot of it came from the homeownership loss. A lot were targeted in the last housing crisis with predatory lending and other type of home searching to young homeowners. They put a lot of their wealth in terms of homeownership, and they were the first one to hit the hardest. They were the first one to lost, and the majority of their wealth was held in terms of homeownership, and that's kind of where they hit the hardest.
Are they going to be will they take the longest to dig out of the problem?
It seems like we hope not. We hope there will be things that will be set up by policies to help them, but they kind of lost off all what they have, and they are in the beginning, and they have the least to build on. So that's kind of tough.
Of course, we think of the younger individuals and families as being resilient, flexible. For example, being able to move to a different place, different city, maybe change their career plans. But the scale of the hit has been significant.
A large part of that, Ray, I think probably has to do with not only have they lost homes or their homes have lost value, but they came into the market with what is called crushing college debt, so many of them.
Yes, many of them did come into college, came to the housing market with a lot of debt. And that's clearly a factor. Student loans, as many of you heard, now top $1 trillion. It's going to take a long time to repay that. And what's becoming clear is that it's not clear that those loans are going to pay off. I think the assumption was that a college degree was always would be the route to upward mobility. But because of the loans, it's not clear that that's the case anymore. And we have some research showing that too much student debt actually has a negative effect on your balance sheet later in life.
One of the things I've been hearing for quite a while now is that in times past, young people coming out of college might change jobs 5 or 6 times during the course of a career. Now they're actually changing careers 5 or 6 times. They're going into entirely different ventures than perhaps they had prepared for. Is that what's going on?
Sure, partly because the economy is still changing so fast. I mean, it's been going on for a very long time. The effects of globalization, technological change, competitive pressures, it definitely makes it puts a premium on being flexible. And that was my point, that luckily younger folks can make those adjustments more easily than someone who's later in their life cycle.
This is not to suggest, Mikhail, that young people are the only ones affected. Their parents also have it pretty tough.
Yeah, unfortunately a lot. In the last recession, everyone lost, you know, a significant portion of their assets. In 2011, almost 20% of the household lost at least a quarter of the resources. You know, just to put some statistics, during the recession, 40% of households were unemployed, missed housing payment, or and underwater loans. So, you know, there are 3 to 4 million workers that separate from the job market each month. So it's really cut across all, in you know, age and income level.
Everybody's been
well, and it, you know, there's generational effects as well. You know, when kids can't get jobs and they live with their parents, and the parents have a hard time meeting their own needs or their own retirement needs, and there's new data showing out that more than 1 in 4 Americans with 401ks and other retirement savings accounts are actually using them to pay current expenses. And these cash outs are, you know, like a quarter of $300 billion a year put into retirement accounts are now getting drained. And those in their 40s have been the hardest hit.
And the price that society is going to have to pay is not today with that regard. It's down the road when they do hit retirement age and there's not much there.
Well, that's exactly right, Don. And it's I think it's been exposed in this downturn, but we've been talking about this for 20 or 30 years or more, that we don't save enough. And part of the saving that we did was inefficient in the sense that we overinvested in housing. And so I think we really do need to keep in mind that this is a longer-term set of issues, that we have known for a long time that people are approaching retirement with inadequate savings.
Am I wrong? And certainly correct me if I am, but it seems to me that I've been hearing since the recession, since 2008, that Americans have done better at saving than they had prior to.
Saving had reached, when it was originally reported back in about 2005, we said the savings rate was negative. Mm-hmm. Well, subsequent revisions have moved that number up, and we now think that the saving rate bottomed out at about 1%. And then, as you say, at the time of the severe recession and financial crisis, household saving rates went up to about 6%. So a very significant reversal. Now, a big part of that was just that there was so much fear and uncertainty that people stopped spending. And, of course, that's what we mean by a recession. Mm-hmm. So the economy was very slow. Mm-hmm. The other important factor is that government policy became very supportive for household incomes. There were automatic stabilizers as well as some legislated changes that both in terms of tax changes and transfer payments and other programs that provided a lot of support for household incomes, and some of that was saved. Of course, the analog is the government's budget became much, much more negative.
Sure. Did you want to add something, Ray?
Well, I was just going to, you know, step back for a second. And if you think about the household balance sheet, there really were 4 failures of American balance sheets over the last few years. The first was that we have about a third of all households who do their banking outside the mainstream. They go to check cashers, payday lenders. They are not going to build wealth. The second failure was the savings, the low savings. As a matter of fact, American savings rates were so low that we reached the lowest level since the 1930s. Third, the debt levels that we accumulated were also unprecedented. By 2007, the ratio of household debt to GDP reached its highest level since the 1950s, and we accumulated more debt from 2001 to 2007 than in the previous 45 years. And our fourth failure of the balance sheet was that we had the highest concentration of wealth in housing since 1952. We were overinvested in housing. It's the convergence of these four failures that we believe led to the crisis.
There are a couple of other numbers here that I'll get out because they're certainly interesting and illustrative. And this comes from you folks at the Fed. The survey of consumer finances of the Federal Reserve would show that overall the median net worth of American households declined 40% between 2007 and 2010. Particularly hard hit were younger, non-white, and non-college educated households. And another one here that is really quite striking. Half the families in this country would not be able to raise $2,000 over a 30-day period.
Well, it's worse than that. It's not just they couldn't raise $2,000 over 30 days. That includes, you know, not just their own balance sheet, but if they had to go to family, friends, payday lenders, check cashers, anybody's balance sheet, they could not do it. About half of all families could not do that.
Well, these numbers are certainly striking. Mikhail, I'll come back to you on this. The numbers are striking, but where are we relative to where we were just a couple of years ago? I mean, there are signs that the economy is getting better, so people must be better off.
People are, but still, this kind of statistics put you on, you know, on the spot that we need to think from policy perspective for what we can do to create some cautionary savings and how we can increase some balance sheet, and increase that.
Part of the work we're doing, and many others, of course, is to look at different segments of the population. And I think a big part of the rebound that we've seen, whether it's economic growth or stock market recovery, that's a relatively smaller part of the population than maybe was what felt prosperous beforehand. And that's, you know, one of the difficult things about this severe recession is that it's hit some families, groups of families, very, very hard. Others have been able to recover much more strongly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the lessons that we're really thinking about is how do we learn from this experience so that people are not as vulnerable to this sort of a big shock in the future.
And that's why you're holding a symposium. The Fed is hosting a symposium later this week. I understand it's totally booked, so folks who are interested will not be able to attend, but we'll just point out that you are hosting research symposium February 5th through 7th at the Fed, designed to help restore household financial stability. Did you want to say something, Ray? It looked like you and Mikhail had something to do.
We were just noting that only two-fifths of the wealth that was lost in the crisis has been recovered. The balance sheet repair is a long way from finished.
Oh, wow.
Stock market has come back, but the housing market hasn't. And stock market wealth is overwhelmingly held by a small group of people. Housing is much more broadly held.
Yep.
And that's I think, why the differences across the population are so stark.
You just heard from Bill Emmons. He's with the Emmons, that is, with the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank. Ray Bishara also with us. He is with the bank as well. Mikhail Grinstein-Weiss is Associate Director of the Center for Social Development at Washington University, also with us in studio. We have to take a break now. Let's do that. We'll come back and talk about what policies you think might be necessary to turn this thing around or at least accelerate it. We'll do that in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on the fallout from the recession. People seem to think that we're pulling out of that now, and I suppose we are, but we have a long way to go and a lot of people have been hurt. The next question we're going to have to deal with during our discussion today is what can be done to accelerate that process. My guests in studio are Ray Bishara and Bill Emmons with the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank, and Mikhail Grinstein-Weiss is Associate Director of the Center for Social Development at Washington University. Okay, let's tackle the big question. What are some of those policies that we might put into place? Who would like to start with that? Go ahead, Bill Emmons.
I'd say that the two major planks of policy response have been dealing with the financial system and the overall macroeconomic policy, so monetary policy and fiscal policy. The third that I think, you know, was very much in discussion early on, there were some actual legislative attempts and regulatory changes, but really hasn't done much, is household focused. So first on the financial system, of course, we talk about the financial crisis that really became severe in September, October of 2008. We had the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, which primarily targeted major financial institutions and then secondary institutions. That, by most accounts, was successful. We stabilized the financial system by sometime in 2009 or so. At about that same time, 2008, 2009, we had, I already mentioned the fact that government programs, tax policies changed dramatically to support household incomes and try to stimulate growth. And, of course, the Fed's monetary policy became extremely stimulative. We cut interest rates essentially to zero at the end of 2008, and that continues today. And according to the latest indications from the Fed's policy committee, it's likely to continue for some time to come. So those, if you will, are the big guns trying to stabilize the financial system and provide a very, very supportive, stimulative effect, not targeted, but a broad-based support for growth. There was, in the Troubled Asset Relief Program, there was money set aside for households to deal with mortgage debt. I think it was $50 billion. To date, less than a tenth of that has been spent. And I think the reason for that is it was so difficult, both operationally but especially politically, to deal with public response to people's mortgage problems.
Well, you say, and you mentioned politics in one breath, and you say that most people would say that the early programs back in 2008, 2009 were a success. I think, Ray, that really depends on your political perspective. I mean, we're all well aware of what's been going on in Washington for these last several years in terms of this gridlock. Well?
Yes. It's been a difficult environment for Congress to do its part.
Well, I think since the 2010 midterms, because if you look, it's ironic, and I think, you know, a lot of people will maybe be surprised, but there was a lot of bipartisan cooperation during the height of the crisis. In fact, we had a changeover of administrations. We went from the Bush administration to the Obama administration. Most people probably don't know which one of those administrations was responsible for some of these programs. For example, the bank bailout, that was a Bush administration policy. And so the cooperation, the recognition that it was a national crisis, in fact, it was an international crisis, really went across party lines. And it was the gridlock that you're talking about really started with the 2010 midterm elections. Part of that was, I would say, a reaction to some of those early responses. For example, the idea of bailing out homeowners. It was extremely unpopular. I always say that the actual beginnings of the Tea Party was a reaction against the idea that we would have a large-scale bailout of underwater borrowers.
I would be interested, McCall, in getting your insight into this. You're an Israeli, is that correct?
Yeah.
So you have watched some of this, I assume, from afar. What have you seen? What has your reaction been to the way all of this has been handled?
Comparing it to Israel, to how it's happening in Israel?
Just looking from the outside, looking into how this country has handled this crisis, what has been your impression of it?
I think one thing that really need to be, this country need to pay attention now, is how fragile, as we said, the middle class. Some of the statistics you put on you can come up with $2,000. We need them is you know, stunning and scary. But I think being an Israeli and coming from Israel, when there is a bigger social support and greater help for people who, you know, don't have health insurance and can get the country to support them, who don't have, you know, a work and get longer unemployment time. So I think we are more socialist in that regard, that we can provide greater caution for people. And I think that is lacking a little bit here. It's not to the same degree. So I think policies and programs really need to start thinking about creating short-term and long-term saving opportunities for everyone. And, you know, everyone, American household, suggest they are interested and they want this kind of opportunities and looking for ways to create emergency savings and also caution savings when you help you respond to opportunities. I think from a policy perspective, we just need to look for more opportunities to create this kind of short-term and long-term savings and try to help everyone. I think the policies have been done in the country were helping more middle and upper class families to save by providing tax incentives for things like homeownership and retirement account, but middle class and poor households were kind of excluded from that. People who don't have these assets did not have other incentives to save, and I think we need to find policies that can help everyone save and encourage and provide incentives and support and access to all households.
You two gentlemen, what do you think of that and the potential for some of the kinds of things that McCall has been talking about?
I think there's a lot of potential. I think the, you know, thinking about the crisis, I think the Fed did a great job stabilizing the financial system, averted a major crisis. But I think we're recognizing now that we have to give equal attention to the household sector. And it's been relatively understudied but increasingly recognized as critical for the well-being of families and the economy. And the policies that McCall talks about are really critical. It's hard for families to save, but there's never been a more important time for families to save and build assets. We talked about these families changing not just jobs but careers. They need a stock of assets to manage, you know, these asset needs through life, whether it's for education, small business development, home ownership. You know, you need the flexibility to navigate a very fast-changing economy, and stocks of flexible assets really are key. And ideally, the earlier in life you have these assets, the better. We have a lot of research showing that asset building is not only a good idea, it's a great idea if you start it early in life.
McCall, you have an idea. I guess it's relatively simple with regard to how people can take advantage of whatever tax refunds they might get to at least add to whatever they have in savings or get started, perhaps.
Right.
What's that idea?
So this is kind of the initiative that we put in place. It's called the Refund to Saving, and it's a partnership with Intuit, a corporation, the makers of the TurboTax. Because that gives us access to a large scale of households who are interested in saving. So we know from previous research, working with low-income communities and with different programs like individual development accounts, is that low-income people want to save and can save when you provide them some incentives and facilitate their way to save. But these kind of programs we found are low cost, are very expensive to implement. They need a lot of, you know, money for the matching incentives and a case manager to work with individuals to help them save, and they are hard to reach scale. So what we were trying to do is to find a program that can reach millions of households. And tax time is a perfect moment because there's so much happening. It's one thing that happens every year. Most families get a refund. Over 75% of families get a refund. For low-income household, the typical refund last year was about $3,000, which almost represents another month of salary pay. And it comes as a lump sum, which means it's an opportunity to put it away. We have seen, again, in research, there are a lot of evidence that people have harder, easier time to put away money when it's, you know, they get like one flow of extra money as opposed to get a little bit more every month. So tax time is really represent a major financial event. There are about 143 million individual returns that are being filed every year. And looking on low-income families, there are almost 61 billion of money come back in EITC. What we have done with Intuit is at that critical moment of the tax time, we introduce some behavioral economics techniques to get people to put some of their money into a saving account automatically on that spot when they are filling their tax refund, walking through the TurboTax customers.
I have a hard time believing, though, that low-income families, by very nature of the fact that they are low income, when they do have a windfall such as we're talking about, are going to put it away and not spend it and use it for coats for the kids in wintertime and that sort of thing.
Right. And this is, I'm very used to get this criticism. And I think we have received a lot of criticism about, in general, can low income people save? Can poor save? And even since this asset building field have started like about 20 years ago. And we have put a lot of programs and a lot of evidence we already generated throughout the last 20 years to show that low income can save, and especially over the last 10 years with programs like individual development account, community advantage program to help low income people, you know, buy a home. People low-income people can find ways to put money aside if they think it will serve to saving, if it provides incentives, and if the right infrastructure to make it easy on the spot. So one of the techniques we are using is we're introducing behavioral economics, which is kind of get people to act in the right moment, do the right thing in the right moment, giving them this option to save and try to introduce some prompt for them to tell them, do you think about the family, you want to start a family? You know, can you take care of your family? Is the best thing is to put a little bit money off to saving, or can you save a little bit for your retirement or for education? And giving them also the infrastructure, give them an automatic mechanism where a part of the money will go automatically to saving, part of it to checking, but part of it to saving, by introducing this form and these opportunities with the IRS.
This is on a very basic level. I'll ask Ray and Bill your thoughts about this. I mean, all this is a mosaic we're basically talking about, from big government down to programs like this. What do you think of a program like this, and how effective could it be?
Well, I think it could be effective. Go back to the point about saving. Can the poor save? Two pieces of evidence that suggest absolutely is that look at our own history. Years ago, we were not as rich as we are today, but our savings rates were higher. So we were relatively poor 100 years ago, and we had high savings rates. Same thing if you look across different countries today. Poor countries save a lot. And so it's absolutely possible. And I think what Michal and Ray both have mentioned is that part of the research and part of what we're really trying to accelerate and bring to a bigger audience is the idea that it has other effects in terms of certainly providing that cushion, but it also it has to do with people's expectations and their attitudes. And I think going back to the issue of policy, I think I will criticize my own field of economics to say that many economists thought it didn't matter if the poor could save because it's not much money anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think what we have seen, and this is kind of something I think Ray often says this, that this is a crisis where those sorts of issues about what happens to the low-income part of the population, now it affects a much, much bigger part of the population. Sure. And so the lack of saving, the vulnerability that people had coming into the crisis now matter for the field.
I understand what you're saying about savings, and I understand why it's important that we save. But at this particular point in our history, our economic history, isn't it also very important to spend? I mean, we need to create jobs. We need to get the dollars out there so that, get the corporations to come off the however many trillions of dollars that they're sitting on and get people at all economic levels out there spending.
Well, that's part of our message. It needs to be sustainable.
Yeah.
And we lived we lived for a number of years on an unsustainable basis. It was based on rapidly appreciating housing and being able to borrow a great deal of money against the house or something else. And part of what we're going through, I think, is an adjustment back to hopefully a more sustainable base of spending. So you're absolutely right that in the short run, if people are saving more, then that's going to slow down the spending. But we need to find a solid bottom so that we can grow on.
Right. I mean, I would just add that what made so much of the spending possible in the last 20 years was debt. And I think we're to the point now where we're not quite sure what drives economic growth if the debt-laden American consumer does not. And that explains some of the sluggishness in our economy. We're not quite sure what follows when you don't have the debt-ridden consumer driving economic growth. And I would also just note that expecting low and moderate income people not to save for the sake of economic growth doesn't quite work. Their stability, their mobility is critical, and that the spending can come from other places, higher income people and from government.
Confidence is a key element here, is it not? I know I mentioned a moment ago that the big corporations are sitting on an awful lot of money because they don't know what our tax policy is going to be. They don't really understand what's going to be happening 6 months from now. Go ahead, Michal.
I wanted to also add just evidence from the last year research that we have done with TurboTax and the refund to saving, and we had about over 100,000 households, very low-income households, go through our intervention and set of prompts and getting them, you know, try to promote them to save, encourage them to save. And we really last year only were in the tax season kind of toward the end. So that's where you get, we were in the tax season doing our intervention between March 15 and April 17. And that's usually when you get the very poor. And we really were working with very, very low income. Also, let me just give you an example. The adjusted gross income, the average was about $13,000 a year annually. They had a very modest refund. Kind of, if I tell you that the for low income in general, a typical refund is about $3,000. This household have a mean of about $1,000 in a refund and a median of $590. And still, we found that they were able to save. And still, we did run an intervention, which is an experiment, when we had several different treatment and several different groups who get different prompt to save, and then a control group who did not receive any, and we still find evidence that for this about over 100,000 household, very, very, very poor household, they were able to save and increase their saving. Mm-hmm.
I find that stunning. I mean, I'm not doubting anything you say, but it just seems counterintuitive to me.
It is counterintuitive, and we spent the better part of 10 years answering that one question, can low-income people save? And I think we've shown pretty convincingly that, in fact, they can. The real questions now are, how do they save and what difference does it make?
Yeah. Let me amplify something that Ray said, too. That I know economists looking at the falling savings rate over the last 20 or 30 years, one of the things that I think almost universally comes out of this research is that there were big changes in the access to credit. It became much easier to borrow for credit cards. Car loans got bigger, student loans, and, of course, the housing-related debt. And so part of the reason that I think we went so far in that direction was because it was so easy to borrow. So part of the financial crisis, you know, people don't like to hear this, but part of the financial crisis was a correction from that environment. Credit is not as easy as it used to be. Yeah. And that's part of why the savings rate's a little higher.
Yeah, we would – I mean, this democratization of credit is often cited as a big success of the 20th century, and I think it was. But that democracy project went too far. Now we need to democratize savings and capital.
I'm going to have to take another break and invite the audience to get into this discussion as well. How have you coped with the recession, and what questions or comments do you have about dealing with it going forward? My guests in studio are Ray Bashar and Bill Emmons from the Federal Reserve Bank. Also with us is Mikhail Grinstein-Weiss, Associate Director of the Center for Social Development at Washington University. Our number is 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email if you like, at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air, and you can also reach us through Facebook. Back to continue our conversation with our guests in studio and with you in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back. As we continue our conversation, we are talking about the recession, where we have been, where we are, and where we are going, and hopefully it's a very positive path that lies ahead. My guests in studio are Ray Bashar and Bill Emmons of the Federal Reserve Bank. Mikhail Grinstein-Weiss from Washington University is also with us. One thing that we should have pointed out earlier, and particularly with regard to the gentleman, Mikhail, perhaps also with you, as you're here as private individuals, you're not representing per se the Federal Reserve Bank in the comments and observations that you have. Okay?
That's right.
Anything you want to add to that?
No.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll start with Jerry calling from O'Fallon, Missouri. Jerry is a regular. Nice to talk to you again, Jerry.
Good morning. Thank you. First of all, I kind of think savings is more a state of mind than anything else. I know people of relatively modest incomes that have accumulated are very financially comfortable. I know people that have, you know, great incomes that, you know, couldn't go more than 2 weeks without their jobs. I think it's just how you set your priorities. But also, I mean, I was born in the 1950s, and the neighborhood I grew up in, it was entirely possible. I mean, everybody practically worked for the Chevrolet plant, the Ford plant, or McDonnell aircraft. And I think even when I entered the workforce in the 70s, it was very possible to not have a high school diploma and find a job that not only paid well, but was secure. And I think that's a big factor as well. In where we find ourselves, and also I think if you did, you know, our economy is over 70% dependent on consumer spending, it was kind of a closed loop. You know, if you bought a color television, it was made in Springfield, Missouri, or somewhere, within the United States. So you were essentially funding, the economy, the domestic economy. And those factors have kind of disappeared, as you know. I don't know of anything that could be done except possibly there are a lot of industrialized countries that have an actual livable minimum wage. And I don't think politically we're going to see this country going there, but that's one aspect, I guess, that could possibly change things, along with consumer education. Thank you.
Thank you for calling, Jerry. Bill?
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of important themes in understanding the economy over the last few decades, globalization, for example. I just mentioned before that I think when economists have looked at all these factors, still the one that stands out is financial liberalization. So, for example, it is true that the volatility of incomes, if you look at individual families, is greater than it used to be. But overall volatility hasn't, at least before the recession, hadn't gone up. It's true that there are pressures on families, less security. But in trying to tease out how important is that, it's the credit that dominates, that it became so easy for so many people to borrow so much money.
Right.
He mentioned culture as well, and I think that's exactly right. You know, many people in my parents' generation and older had school savings programs. Those are gone. And so we're very involved in efforts around the country to start savings accounts at birth or when kids enter kindergarten to recreate that culture of savings in America.
You know, there is we're talking about the baby boomers these days, the 77 million baby boomers. Many of their parents were born during the Depression or grew up perhaps during the Depression. And that created an entirely different dynamic. All of the people I know who came out of that were savers because they had just gone through this awful, awful period. I wonder if what we've been going through here most recently is likely to cause that to happen again.
Mm. I'd like to mention that there was some research done a few years ago that found exactly what you're saying, Don, that people born before, I think the year was 1944, anyone born before 1944 had a very different savings rate than anybody born after that date. And it everybody, I think, would agree it has a lot to do with having lived through that experience or your parents lived through it. Will that be similar today? I think not. Mm-hmm. I think that the bounce that we saw in the savings rate indicated this was a very severe shock to a lot of people, but it's actually been drifting down again. And if you look at, for example, the dependence of our economy on consumer spending, all of the efforts to rejuvenate the credit flows, and the very, very strong, in the short run, of course, we're all happy that we didn't have a deeper downturn, but in fact, it really saved us from feeling all of those corrections that probably were built up. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why we're in this protracted recovery, is instead of having the severe downturn, which probably would have changed attitudes significantly, we've instead delayed the adjustment processes. And I worry a little bit that the messages, and that's really one of the reasons for this project, the messages of sort of the wrong path we were on, I think, in terms of our own financial thinking and cultural attitudes towards savings, I think those have been diluted and somehow maybe even obscured. And I'm not sure we're going to learn from the crisis, as you were saying, maybe the same kind of lesson.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead, Demichelle.
If I can just add a really quick note. So again, everything we are bringing up here is really showing that it's can be different culture, different age culture, whether you went through the previous depression or the Great Recession right now, and can we kind of bet on that, develop a different culture for everyone and not just if you go through a major financial crisis. I think, again, being Israeli and bring some example from back home, I agree again with Ray what he said about how it's so much culture. We have much, much higher culture of savings. And one norm is that you can't almost get married if you're not ready to buy a home. So people will delay getting married until they are ready to buy a home because homeownership is such an important saving component. And to start a family, you want to be homeowner. And people will stay to live with their parents for, like, will get married and stay living with their parents until they're ready to make this commitment. So, you know, there are work to also maybe be done culturally and how we can change the culture here.
I kept running across the term and getting ready for this program that I don't think I fully understand, perhaps, and that is behavioral economics. What is that?
Well, it's really it's not a fully fledged body of thought at this point, but it's sort of a started really as a collection of observations that people, real people, don't behave exactly the way economists assume they behave in writing down their models.
Economists don't even behave.
Think about it this way. There's a huge gap between our intentions and our behavior. Behavioral economists are trying to close that gap.
It's really kind of bringing psychology, I would say, and sociology into economics.
There is a lot of evidence that people are actually, not rational. And behavioral economics can, you know, I'll give you an example of one study, and then it's looking on one technique that's called anchoring, which is setting a saving goal. And we know that the higher we set a saving goal, the people save more. There was a seminal work that was done by Tversky and Kahneman in like 70s, when they ask people, they ask them to spin a wheel and generate a random number, and you generate a random number, you see the number, and then they got the question, what percent of countries in Africa belong to the UN? Now, even though the people knew that the number was random, the higher the number, the higher the guest, and the lower the number they had, the lower the guest. And we, for example, implement that with the saving research. So even in the IDA program, they hired the goal. We told people you need to save $50 a month. You'll see them saving closer to, $50. And you'll compare to people who tell them save $30, they'll save less. And we did the same thing in the refund to saving. And we suggest people how much they should save from the refund, a 75% versus a 25%. You see a huge impact that really people will, if I will tell them, okay, you need to save 75% of the refund, and that's if you have a refund of $3,000, that will be $2,200. Even if people won't keep the $2,200, they will change it to $2,100. You know, they will stay close to a set, to the goal, to a default we suggested. As opposed if we suggest 25%, which is like will be 760, they will, stay around close to that. So this is one example of a behavioral economics techniques, and there are a bunch of them showing that people are not rational. They're reacting to all kind of things, and we can use them when we're developing policy because we know that that's how people react.
Let's take another phone call. Thank you, Mikhail. We'll bring in Scott calling from Chesterfield. He wants to get into the savings discussion as well. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, Japan is kind of still in a slow growth or recession since 1990, and some people speculate that's because they save too much money.
Thank you, Scott. Yeah, that kind of goes to what we're talking about.
That was an early, I would say, in the 90s, that was a leading hypothesis, but I'd say by today that's not true. People who study it would not say that's the problem. For one reason, saving, in fact, has gone down dramatically in Japan. The savings rate is not as high.
It used to be around 5%, which was considered good, wasn't it?
Well, 20 years ago, the household savings rate were in double digits.
In Japan, well.
And they've come down quite a bit. I think the thing that economists studying this today would say, it's a combination of big changes in their economy, the demographics, for example. It's a very rapidly aging population. But also the financial system really was not it didn't come through their original crisis very well, and it ended up kind of putting this – and I would say – unfortunately, there are echoes of that going on now here, that we, rather than clearing out the problems to begin with, they had huge asset bubbles and too much debt, and instead of clearing out those problems, they hid them and postponed them, and it just then became sort of embedded, sort of a slow growth mentality. And I'm concerned that we have not faced up to the debt overhang coming out of this crisis, and it, I think, is having an inhibiting effect on our recovery.
I'm going to take another call now from Art in South City. Art, I'll ask you please to make it a brief question or comment. Are you there?
Appreciate you taking the call. $1 trillion is $1,000 bills laid flat 58.6 miles high, and I have a long-term view of a depreciating currency. I have a modest decline in our budget deficit, and we have to maintain a positive growth in the economy. Now, my concern is the carry interest, trade and barter income that these $3 trillion floating around in the currency markets are generating, along with the sales of the U.S. dollar by the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve. I'm just wondering what the policy is. Is America up for sale with the government selling of the U.S. currencies out into the currency markets?
Let's get a response to that, Art. Thanks for the call. Who would like to take that? To Bill?
I'm not quite sure what the question was, but I think the response to the crisis by the Fed, by the Treasury, by the Congress, those responses were extraordinary. And I think everybody involved originally thought that we would be finished with it by now, and that hasn't happened. We're still on emergency footing. So I think some of those numbers that the caller was mentioning are just so staggering, in part because we're still kind of fighting the crisis.
In the time we have left, and it'll have to be relatively brief, what is the role for government moving forward? Ray, what do you think? I mean, the government is inhibited too because it has its own economic problems, financial problems.
Well, I think the government has a huge role in this, and it's not our job, of course, to tell Congress what to do. But looking at the research, what's clear is that the government is already in the business of helping families save and build wealth and reduce their debts. The problem is they're basically doing it for the upper half of the population and not for everybody. So those who most need balance sheet repair are getting the least amount of help.
Mm-hmm. Bill, thoughts?
I would say that I think it's important for the government today to be fair, as Ray said, to those alive today, but also be fair to future generations and not pass the problems or the solutions, make the future generations pay for those solutions.
I would just add that I think one of the best policies to close this gap and to create opportunity afresh is to endow every generation with a savings account at birth or when they enter kindergarten so they can start the long-term process of saving, building wealth, building financial literacy and skills, and have funds for buying a home or going to college later in life.
Who would do the endowment? The government?
They would seed the account, set up the infrastructure, but the idea is even if it's $50 or $100, the idea would be that it would be a magnet for contributions from family, friends, and others.
Michal, yeah, that, you like that idea?
I love this idea, and I think we have a lot of evidence that that's something that may work, that something that low-income people who have an account are just the existing of account, they are 7 times more likely to go to college than people who don't have an account, and it doesn't even matter how much money they have in the account. So I think that's the way to go, and we need that at scale. We need that to try to reach everyone, and especially to create that, you know, for low income and middle-class income.
It's not a pipe dream. It's being tried all over the world.
Right.
And, well, we certainly want people to go to college, and we just have a minute left. What about the role of the corporations? And, again, loosening some of that money so that they can create jobs so these college graduates have someplace to work.
Right. I think, as you said, Don, that many, many companies are ready to hire, ready to invest. They have the cash in their on their own balance sheets, they have the ability to raise money. But they, I believe, my interpretation is they are not convinced that the economy is sound yet, yeah, that we're poised for growth yet.
Any other quick thought, Rick?
Well, 70 million workers don't have access to a 401k. Government can help expand that.
Yeah, it's going to be devastating down the road, isn't it? Very quick thought from you, Michal, a final thought?
Infrastructure, again, something that you can deliver from the government to a lot of people, and create emergency caution and create some assets for the future.
We have plenty of need for infrastructure improvements. There's no question about that, and it's being talked about a lot, but there again, not much seems to be happening. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Most interesting discussion. I guess there's a reason to be positive, but there's also a reason to be thinking, gee, This is going to take a long time to dig out. Thank you very much, Reba Shara and Bill Emmons. Nice to see you. And Mikhail Grinstein-Weiss, thank you so much for being with us. A pleasure seeing
you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
Before we leave, we have an on-air correction to make. In our St. Louis on the Air program about synesthesia on January 24th, Britt Brogard was identified as the director of the St. Louis Synesthesia Lab at the University of Missouri St. Louis and Christian Marlowe as the lab's associate director. Those titles are incorrect, and the University of Missouri St. Louis does not have a lab or center devoted to research on synesthesia, though it is Britt Brogard's area of expertise. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Krista Tippett about her work as host and producer of the American Public Media program Krista Tippett on Being. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.